This is Due South Broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. I'm Jeff Tabiri. Super Tuesday is complete. This hour, we'll delve into what happened and, to the extent we can decipher, why, as well as how the results may impact the next 8 months of campaigning, whether there were any surprises, there were, when we can expect the incessant mailers and ads to resume. Spoiler, they're not really going to stop. And who might have had the best night in North Carolina? This is the latest installment in our Purple Ballot series, and we are glad to have you along for this hour-long ride. Indeed, the primary here in the Old North State is over, except, of course, for the races that do not yet have a winner and now head to a second primary. We're going to get to those crowded contests in a bit. Also in the queue, congressional races, Council of State contests, notable legislative races, and check-ins with reporters in New Hanover, Mecklenburg, and Buncombe counties. First, our guests for the hour, Colin Campbell, WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief, Maya King, New York Times reporter, and Chris Cooper, Professor of Political Science and Public Affairs at Western Carolina University. Good morning to you all.
Morning.
Hey, good morning, Jeff.
All right. Right off the bat, we have lots to put our hands on and decipher and analyze and talk about, but I want to go in a slightly different direction. What is the biggest lingering question that Super Tuesday did not answer for you? Colin Campbell, you're first up.
Oh, that's a tricky one. I'm just trying to wrap my head around some of these Republican primary results, just trying to figure out what sort of takeaways we can get from some of these, particularly the crowded races.
Yeah.
You know, was it just about money? Is it just about, you know, ballot order? The turnout was so low that I feel like if I try to make too many conclusions out of it, I'm perhaps working with too small of a sample size in my poll that's the actual election. So I think that's a challenge as you think about that.
Good thoughts for sure. Chris Cooper, what is left unanswered in your mind on this this March 6th?
Yeah, I mean, I think what this means for November is pretty much unanswered, right? This is, as Colin said, it's an incredibly small turnout election. It's a primary. It's not a general. And so if you're trying to extrapolate what this might mean for November, I think it's really, really difficult to do it. I think we need to be careful. I think we need to spend time thinking about what last night meant and not thinking for a second about what last night means for November.
And to underscore that point just a little bit, and you all are the experts,
sure,
and I'm going to try to get out of the way here. This is a primary unlike any other in American history. We have the two oldest candidates for president from the major parties, and the dynamics of March are likely going to be very different in some ways than, you know, the prize on the line and some of the dynamics come November. We don't know what's going to happen economically. We don't know what's going to happen in international foreign relations, and things, although we have a sense of who's going to be on the ballot in 8 months, could feel quite differently in some ways, I think. Maya King, what's unanswered for you today?
Yeah, I'm with Chris. You know, we don't really know what's going to happen in November, and that's not really any clearer, I think, after last night. You know, I'm really interested in what the electorate is going to do, particularly young voters and voters of color. Democrats in particular have held up North Carolina as a state that's given them hope many, many cycles past, as I'm sure folks know better than me here on this panel. And they pointed a lot to demographic change in the major metropolitan areas as an indicator of the state being in play for them. But I'm just wondering if that's really, you know, what could come to pass in November, and if North Carolina could indeed be, as one Democrat put it at a victory party I attended last night, the state that leads the South once again.
That's Maya King from the New York Times. She was with the Josh Stein campaign last night. The Democratic Attorney General does move on, as you've heard on newscasts throughout the morning. He will face Mark Robinson in the general gubernatorial election. We're going to get really into the nuances of that race here in a few moments. But sticking with the big picture for the moment, I want to note turnout, because Colin noted it. I think all three of you might have just noticed it. Colin Campbell's here in studio, and Chris Cooper is on the line from Western North Carolina. Turnout last night, 24%. As one metric point, the last general election primary we had 4 years ago, primary turnout was 31%. Now, these are not good numbers. Let's just note that off the top, relative to, you know, 80 or 85% turnout, fine. But 4 years ago, 31% of registered voters cast ballots in the 2020 primary. This year, 24% cast ballots. That's a reduction of more than 20%. Chris Cooper, why, knee-jerk, initial reaction, why do you think we had that kind of, lack of participation?
You know, it wasn't because of competitiveness at the congressional level, because goodness knows we had some really interesting competitive congressional primaries. I think what it says is people are not excited about the top of the ticket. Maybe they're also just kind of done with politics right now, which really, who can blame them? It also just seemed, and this is not really empirical, just my sense of the world, it seemed a little less fever pitched than usual. My mailbox, yeah, I had flyers, but kind of fewer flyers than I'm used to. There just seemed to be a little bit less awareness this time, a little bit more cynicism, a little bit more just kind of sick of it, and maybe sick of these candidates. In the bottom of the ballot, we thought maybe, or the middle of the ballot, we thought maybe would drive turnout. It just seems that wasn't true. Even if you look at the congressional districts with the highest turnout, at least in terms of the early vote, those, the ones that were the most interesting, weren't necessarily the ones with the highest turnout. The highest turnout in the state for early vote was in my 11th congressional district way out west. And frankly, we didn't have a very interesting or competitive primary. So I think it says top of the ticket drove things. Top of the ticket was pretty boring.
Colin, a thought here?
Yeah. So I mean, this top of the ticket, as Chris mentioned, just there's nothing to come out and vote for if you're looking at the presidential level. And that's usually what drives turnout in a presidential year primary. We didn't have that. The Republican side seemed like a foregone conclusion from weeks ago. And of course, we heard the not so surprising news first thing this morning that Nikki Haley is suspending her campaign. And that pretty much cements the path for Donald Trump if it wasn't cemented already. Joe Biden was the only Democratic candidate allowed to be on the ballot in North Carolina. But the Democrats didn't have a choice. And there just wasn't a whole lot of information out there. I mean, I think I got a couple of mailers at home. I was chatting with one of my fellow colleagues who was working late into the night on our election coverage. And she mentioned that she was chatting with her friends and they didn't understand why she had to work late tonight as a journalist, because they didn't realize there was an election happening.
I'm sorry to laugh at you. That's obviously not a good sign of participation and engagement with the primary. A quick housekeeping note off the top, and I'm going to say this as much for me as any of you. Numbers in radio are a dangerous thing. So as we get into this and we look at runoffs and percentages and vote differentials, I'm going to try to, you know, rein it in a little bit on the numbers, because it can be hard when you're listening and not looking at those numbers to kind of process them. But that also can be hard morning after, because there are so many numbers in front of us. I want to ask another big, broad question here, just to gauge y'all's read on it or sense of it. And if you want to call me crazy, I'm going to encourage you to be like, that is a little bit too much, Jeff. Not enough sleep for you. It has been written for generations, right, that politics is the art of the compromise. It's also the art of what is possible. And one of the most lingering, or one of the most unanswered questions for me, is whether or not there is time for the unlikeliest of 2024 political marriages to still take place. And I am wondering if any of you will nibble on the possibility, and I'm going to start with you, Maya King, the possibility of a Donald Trump, Nikki Haley ticket come November. Has that crossed your mind?
No.
Okay.
I think if we just look at the past several months, Nikki Haley, I'm going to take her at her word when she says, I'm not interested in running for vice president. I'm not interested in sort of an inside track in the party. And I am willing to be proven wrong on that. But I do think that she has alienated the MAGA base that really adores Trump and wants someone who will be all in for the president as his running mate. And Haley, having stayed in the race this long, and at least in the last few weeks been much more critical of him, is probably not a contender in that right. And hers is not a name I've heard at all on the list of vice presidential contenders here. I think one of the unofficial requirements for vice president, or to be Trump's vice president, is essentially to do exactly what he says in the primary. And the folks who have already dropped out, suspended their campaigns, and immediately endorsed the former president are those who are kind of following that playbook.
Sure. Chris or Colin, do either of you want to nibble on this? I don't mean to sound overly conspiratorial, and I do not think that this is likely, of course, but I just wanted to throw it out there.
You know, there's probably some Republicans who would like to see that as some sort of unity ticket, but I think, like Maya said, Trump just ain't going to go for it. I mean, he's going to sort of view her as someone who's going to seek revenge against, as opposed to want to work with. And he's got a big pool of candidates, including South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, who ran for president without criticizing him too much and have now gone all in on supporting Trump and seem to be almost auditioning for his vice presidential slot now.
All right. Chris, just another moment or here, a moment here or so before we'll step aside. Any thoughts on this, this to be determined VP thing? Probably no time soon.
Yeah, I think no time soon. I agree with the other panelists. I mean, look, you can point to a few years ago where he said all sorts of Trump said all sorts of terrible things about Ted Cruz, and Ted Cruz came around. But in this case, I don't think anybody's coming around. I think he cares about loyalty more than anything else. And say what you want about Nikki Haley, she's not really loyal to Donald Trump. Therefore, I think she fails the first test. She's not going to be the vice president anytime soon.
Chris Cooper, political scientist and a professor of public affairs at Western Carolina University, is with us here on Due South. So too is Colin Campbell, WUNC's Capitol Bureau Chief, and Maya King. She is a reporter with the New York Times, and she spent a part of yesterday in Raleigh, capital city, City of Oaks, here in North Carolina with the Josh Stein campaign. We're going to spend some time on the other side discussing that gubernatorial race. Most gubernatorial elections do not take place in general election years, but North Carolina's will, as it usually does, and it is a fascinating race that now has solidified. The contours of it are clear. It is Josh Stein and Mark Robinson. We'll discuss money and endorsements and some of the other issues at play when we return in a moment. We're also this hour going to get to a big surprise, and that big surprise saw an incumbent, a Republican incumbent of statewide office, a superintendent of public instruction, go down last night to a grassroots candidate. It was surprising, and we'll maybe weigh into the why. Also this hour, vengeance and redemption, and for those two big words, we will head to Mecklenburg County. I'll give you a clue. It's Mark Harris and Cotham. I won't tell you which Cotham. Much more to come here on Due South, the latest installment of our Purple Ballot series, as we try to digest and dissect some of what happened last night on Super Tuesday in North Carolina and across the American South. Do stay with us. This is WUNC. Welcome back. It is Due South here on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Colin Campbell, WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief, is in studio. Chris Cooper, professor from Western Carolina University, is on the line. So too is Maya King, New York Times reporter, who's heading back I-85 southbound toward Atlanta, her home post. My name is Jeff Tabiri. Glad to have you along as we break down some of the Super Tuesday results. There are congressional contests to discuss. There were effectively five open seats. We'll tell you about some of the faces, some of the names that moved on here in a little bit, including two races that are headed to a runoff. But let's spend some time now on the gubernatorial contest that is taking form here in North Carolina. Josh Stein, the Democratic Attorney General, garnered nearly 70% of the votes last night. These are uncertified results, of course. And he will take on Mark Robinson, the Greensboro native who came to some level of fame when he won a lieutenant governor's race 4 years ago and was not expected to do so. He has since been something of a lightning rod in North Carolina politics. Maya King, you have covered this race from afar and up close. You were with Robinson and Josh Stein in recent days. Let's start with Stein, because you were with the Stein campaign last night in Raleigh. Tell us a little bit about how Josh Stein framed up his victory message and what he said as he took sights at the general.
Well, his victory message, his message at his victory party last night was very policy focused. I found that he spoke a lot about strengthening the healthcare system in North Carolina, making sure that teachers were paid well. He talked a lot about violent crime and leaned really heavily into his record as Attorney General of North Carolina. And when he wasn't talking about policy, he was talking about Mark Robinson. I think that's exactly what we're going to hear a lot of in the next few months on the campaign trail, is the comparisons between his campaign and his platform and that of Mark Robinson, particularly as it relates to abortion and Robinson's support of an abortion ban. Some of the comments that Robinson has made that vilify trans people. He said things that are anti-Semitic as well. We know that Stein is also a Jewish man, so I think that's going to be a part of his message, is sort of the hate, the vitriol, and the distraction that Robinson poses as a candidate. And I think that is a pretty powerful message. Folks were very excited to hear from him last night. And again, as I said at the top of the show, I think the North Carolina Democrats are very interested in not only winning this governor's race, but possibly delivering the state for Biden in November. And that might be too far of a reach, you know, for me to say whether or not that's going to happen in March. But it does sort of, I think that Stein has established the party's goals here, and they are certainly on one accord with that. You know, it just is very clear that Democrats here want to send a message to the rest of the South and to the rest of the country in November.
I want to ask you a quick follow-up here, Maya. And there are a lot of different threads to pull on with this gubernatorial race. But to the extent you have a sense of it, whether it's anecdotal or if you've talked with strategists, I'm interested in what you think of the name factor with Josh Stein, right? Josh Stein is Jewish. This is both a name thing and a faith thing specific to him. We've never had a Jewish governor before in our state. We've only had, I believe, one member of Congress from North Carolina who was ever of the Jewish faith. This is happening at a time. Pardon me, this was happening at a time when we've got the war between Israel and Hamas playing out, as well as this rising level of anti-Semitism across our country. So I think I just took like four things and threw them against the wall. But do you have any sense or expectation as to how this element of Stein's retail candidacy may or may not influence this race moving forward?
I have asked about this. I've asked his campaign this exact question, and I posed it as it relates to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, because that seems to be what is really animating voters and young voters. You can't go to any Democratic event, at least a national Democratic event, and not encounter protesters who are calling for a ceasefire. I think that Vice President Harris calling for a ceasefire on Saturday she called for the ceasefire in Alabama on Sunday. It opened up, though, you know, a little bit more room, I think, for down ballot Democrats to embrace that position. And I asked if we could expect to see that from Stein. I don't think that their plans there are public yet, and I'm really not sure what they are as it relates to how he will really discuss this. But, you know, Stein has in the past said that he supports aid to Gaza, mm-hmm. and also support and also has condemned in no uncertain terms the attacks on October 7th. And so I think there's a little bit more room for him to make more suggestions there. And I believe that I and other reporters will really be pressing him on this. But it is an important question. And I'll also just throw in one more thing. Please. About Stein that I find really interesting here, is that there are a lot of similarities between his race for governor in North Carolina and that of Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania. These are both former attorney generals who went to the governor's mansion from the AG's office. These are also two Jewish men also running in a state where that doesn't have much of a legacy. And they're both running, in Stein's case, and this was true of Shapiro, against two sort of firebrand Republican candidates who, while very popular among the base, said a lot of things that scared voters, yeah. I think, and sort of alienated the mm-hmm. Republican coalition and allowed them to coast to victory that way. So that's another thing I'm just going to be watching for.
That's really interesting. That's Maya King on the line. She's with us as she's heading back to her home in Atlanta. She's been covering the gubernatorial race here. She's a reporter with the New York Times. A little bit of context, then I want to pivot to WNC Capitol Bureau Chief Colin Campbell here on Due South as we're discussing some of the Super Tuesday results. So as we think about Pennsylvania versus North Carolina, I would just point out that Pennsylvania is a little bit more blue than North Carolina. It's not drastically so, but these are battleground states. And one other thing, just to mention as a contextual civics reminder, our state has voted for a Democratic presidential candidate precisely once in the last 48 years. Since Jimmy Carter, only has North Carolina gone blue for the president in 2008. That was for Barack Obama. He carried the state by 14,000 votes. It's also worth noting, civics thing here, that across the last 60 years or so, in our last 13 general elections, North Carolinians have shown a proclivity to split their tickets, Republican presidential candidates and Democratic gubernatorial candidates. I believe they've done that 9 out of the last 13 general elections. So it's an interesting dynamic that has happened. The ticket splitting numbers have come way down in recent years, but it did, of course, happen in 2016 and 2020 with voters in our state backing Donald Trump and Roy Cooper. So that's just some civics backdrop that I know a lot of our listeners know. Colin, I want to hone in with you on the Republican side of this gubernatorial race. So Mark Robinson, the firebrand, the man who has spent time at the dais as a pastor saying some really outlandish things, he's a Trump acolyte. And I think that's a kind of a fair categorization. He won this primary going away. He garnered nearly 2 out of every 3 votes. In second place was Dale Falwell. Dale Falwell is a former state lawmaker. He was the first Republican treasurer in a century and a half in North Carolina. And I'm interested with Falwell as a microcosm from your perspective, Dale Falwell, do you think he comes around and supports Mark Robinson? And do you think other Republicans who voted for Dale Falwell, voted for Bill Graham, didn't want to back Mark Robinson? It's ostensibly the Trump question, but on a North Carolina level, are they going to come home? Are they going to back Mark Robinson? What's your sense of that?
That's the big question. I saw Falwell tweeted something that was sort of gracious in defeat, but what didn't really address whether he was going to go all in for Robinson. Bill Graham, the other Republican in that race, basically said, let's just statement to the effect of, well, I guess we're going to lose in the general election as Republicans. So it didn't seem like he's going to be jumping on the Robinson train. I mean, if anything was surprising about the results in the governor's primary was just the sheer numbers for both Stein and Robinson. Stein went away with 70% of the vote. The thought that black voters might abandon him for former state Supreme Court Justice Mike Morgan, that didn't pan out. I think Morgan only got like 15%. And we didn't have that many moderates abandoning Robinson, who, as you mentioned, went, you know, got 65%. So I think that we're unlikely to see a huge number of Republicans not back Robinson. But the question is, you have sort of the policy wonk lane, which is 100% Dale Falwell. This guy is he's not the most exciting politician, but he's all about the policy. And that seems to be not the direction the Republican Party, either at the state or national level, is going at this point. And the question is whether those folks stay home. Do they still vote their straight ticket, or do they hold their nose and vote for a Democrat? I think probably remains to be seen. But I think there's so few of them, it may not make that big of a difference.
We're going to turn our attention to Steve Harrison in just a moment. But before we do that, Chris Cooper has been waiting patiently, hopefully with something strong and caffeinated on the line in Western North Carolina. Chris, I want to, throw a little bit of water on this gubernatorial contest. We spend a lot of time, us in the news media, and I understand it, but we're going to spend a lot of time on this race. We're going to see, $70, $80, $100 million come into this race across the next 8 months. And I want to throw a little bit of water on it, potentially, by noting that this governor's seat is one of the weakest governor's seats in the country. I know that because you've taught me that, Professor Cooper. It's 49th or it's 50th. This is not a particularly powerful position. And I'm wondering, from your perspective as a political expert, if you think perhaps too much money and too much attention gets spent on the gubernatorial race, and if perhaps some of the money would be better spent elsewhere.
Yes, is the short version, right? I mean, in terms of legislation, they have almost no power at all. And then if you add to that, if the Republicans are able to keep the supermajority, then the one arrow that the governor has in his quiver, the veto power, will essentially be gone. So in terms of legislation, if the Republicans keep the supermajority, call it Mark Robinson, call it Josh Stein, it's really not going to make a dime's worth of difference in the policies that are passed out of the state of North Carolina. It is a position that is born out of the bully pulpit. It's a position that's born out of rhetoric. And so absolutely, the real rubber meets the road in North Carolina at the judicial level and at the state legislative level, what we call the General Assembly in our state. And yes, if some of our attention and money was put there, I think it would be better spent. With that said, I don't see any hope of that happening. It seems to be we're all sort of living in this fantasy that this is the most important position in the state. And although they might have the best house in the state, it's not the most important position.
This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi, and let's turn our ears toward the Queen City. Steve Harrison is a political reporter with NPR member station WFAE in Charlotte, and we're going to chat about both redemption and vengeance with Steve this morning. Let's begin in North Carolina's 8th Congressional District, where Mark Harris is the projected winner. As a brief reminder, the Republican ran for Congress previously, 2016 and 2018, and 6 years ago, he appeared to have won a seat in the U.S. House. However, that's before a ballot-harvesting election fraud scandal unraveled the possibility of him going to Washington. Well, Harris decided to take another crack at Congress, and it appears he's on his way. Steve Harrison, what can you tell us about Mark Harris's victory?
Like you said, Jeff, he has been in political wilderness for 5 years. No one has heard from Mark Harris. But when Dan Bishop said he was going to run for attorney general, that created an open seat. He jumped in, and he is going to squeak it out, it looks like. He is at 30.4%. The threshold for a runoff is 30. And what I think is interesting is that Harris had a lot going against him in terms of the past, in terms of this mail ballot scandal. He had hired the political operative McRae Dallas, who was criminally charged. So he had kind of the past. But then in the present as well, there were two Republican super PACs who poured significant money in this race, really trashing Mark Harris. His two leading opponents, former Union Commissioner Alan Baucom and Mecklenburg State Representative John Bradford, each spent $1 million of their own money. Harris, I think, spent about $400. So he was outgunned. But Mark Harris, many of the counties in the 8th are the same counties he ran in the old 9th in 2018. He knows a lot of these people. He works hard. He's a good campaigner, and he it paid off last night. He is almost certainly going to go to Congress.
I suppose we should note there is the theoretical mathematical possibility that if all of the remaining votes that are out there come in a really disproportionate way, that this could tick things below 30% for Mark Harris. Like, I suppose that's within the realm of possibilities, but it would appear to be unlikely from a mathematical standpoint. I'm interested, Steve, if you can give us a sense of what Mark Harris said last night in his victory speech.
It was, I would kind of characterize it as, you know, most of these celebrations are, people are obviously thrilled, right? They have won their race. Harris, it took Harris a while to get to the joy part. His big theme initially was repudiation. He talked about the union voters have repudiated these untrue attacks, these nasty attacks on me and you, et cetera. Mark Harris has gone through a lot. Perhaps he brought it on himself. Perhaps, you know, his view is he was treated unfairly. But he has gone through a lot. And his campaign event last night was he was kind of unloading in a way. That was kind of how I saw it. There was a lot of anger still.
Steve Harrison, political reporter with WFAE on the line here on Due South. Should also note that this 8th district is drawn favorably to Republicans, and Mark Harris is expected to carry the election in November as well. Let's transition to one of North Carolina's most notorious state lawmakers these days, Tricia Cotham. She was unopposed in a Republican primary to keep her seat in the North Carolina House, where, a reminder, she went from Democrat to Republican last spring. Who will challenge Cotham on the Democratic side in November?
Nicole Sidman won a three-person Democratic primary for the seat, which is a kind of a South Charlotte suburban seat. It's a political toss-up. Sidman had raised the most money, I think, is the result that a lot of Democrats wanted to see in terms of who they feel is the best person to take on Tricia Cotham.
Okay. We talked about redemption with Harris. I want to talk about vengeance as it pertains to the Cotham family. A little anecdote about coattails and collateral damage here. Just to set it up, 16 years ago, I was reminded of this when I was driving home late last night. Bev Perdue and Kay Hagan were really swept into the governor's mansion and the U.S. Senate, respectively, thanks in large part due to the invigorating campaign of one Barack Obama. And these are often called political coattails. And last night, the much-discussed and analyzed flip-flop of one Tricia Cotham seems to have branched out and impacted the family tree. Tell us what happened to Tricia Cotham's mother on Tuesday night.
Pat Cotham is her mother. She has been a Mecklenburg commissioner since 2012. She is a Democrat, and she's always won re-election easily. Never a problem. But last night was the first time the Cotham name has been on a ballot since the switch. And voters here made her pay, clearly. I mean, clearly, she finished fourth. The top three would have won. She finished a distant fourth, a massive loss of votes compared to 2 years ago. Very clearly, some voters perhaps thought maybe they were voting against Tricia Cotham. I'm sure other voters did realize it was her mother and said, you know what, I'm going to vote against the Cotham name regardless. So whatever the opposite of coattails are, they were certainly evident in Mecklenburg last night.
And just to put a finer point on it, Pat Cotham has long been a Democrat in this municipal body, and she, unless you're about to break any news to me and our listeners here, she has not cast any controversial votes or hasn't taken any flip-flopping stances or any notable positions here in the last year. This is very much a vote that is tethered to her name, right?
Pat Cotham has been a kind of a moderate Democrat. There's been some grumblings that she's, you know, the county has moved much more to the left over the last 10 years, and Pat Cotham's kind of stayed in the center. Some mild grumbling about that. But if there were no Tricia Cotham party switch, then Pat Cotham would have won easily.
Steve Harrison from WFAE on the line with us for another moment here on Due South. You are in Mecklenburg County. We have noted here in the program today that turnout not good from an overall primary standpoint relative to 4 years ago, down about 20% in the neighborhood of 24% of registered voters turned out on this Super Tuesday or for this Super Tuesday primary. Can you narrow the lens to Mecklenburg County and tell us what you're able to discern in the immediate aftermath?
Yeah, you know, Mecklenburg is the second biggest county in the state, the biggest pool of Democratic voters, a big warning sign for Democrats going into November. Turnout in Mecklenburg was under 19%. If you look at the other big urban counties where there are a lot of Democratic voters, Mecklenburg was at the bottom. And this has been the case for a while, and it's been a big problem for Democrats. You just simply can't win statewide. It's very hard to win statewide when Mecklenburg is kind of dragging at the back. It's been a problem for a while, and it hasn't seemed to have fixed itself this election cycle.
Steve Harrison is political reporter for WFAE in Charlotte. Steve, thank you for the time on a limited amount of sleep. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff.
There is much more for us to get to here on Due South on this morning after the Super Tuesday primary here in North Carolina. Don't know that I have even mentioned specifically the name Michelle Morrow. She upset Catherine Truitt last night, and she will be the Republican nominee for state superintendent. We'll discuss perhaps how she was able to do this, a surprise upset on Tuesday night. There also were a number of open congressional races, five of them, as a matter of fact, and we'll tell you about what happened in those on the other side. This is Due South on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Welcome back to listener-supported WUNC. This is Due South. I'm Jeff Tiberi in our Durham studios with Colin Campbell, WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief. On the line on I-85 is Maya King, New York Times reporter, and also joining us from Western North Carolina is Chris Cooper, professor of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University. You've been hearing many of the results from the attorney general to gubernatorial, congressional contests, and so much more during newscasts this morning. As a reminder, you can check out our website, WUNC.org, if there's anything you don't think you're up to date on, or perhaps you missed, or perhaps I was not able to get to here on Due South. Maya King has much to get to, but before we say thanks and sign off with her, would love maybe that, 2,500, 3,000-foot view. Maya, you were based in Georgia. You spent some time here in North Carolina looking at the religious dynamics, looking at the gubernatorial race. For you, what is top of mind long before the general, but in the next 3 or 4 months, what are you going to be paying attention to as it pertains to North Carolina politics?
I think really I'll be paying attention to how much attention North Carolina gets. And I know that's kind of a flip response, but it is true. I mean, this is obviously a marquee race in terms of the governor's race here in North Carolina, and it will get a lot of national attention. And I just wonder if we can expect to see a level of investment from national Democrats and Republicans, more visits and rallies from former President Trump and President Biden and others, and whether that pales in comparison to other southern states that are in play, namely Georgia. And not to compare, two political states that have a lot of differing dynamics, but just in conversations with political strategists in both states, it sounds like that's also what a lot of people are looking towards is, the level of investment and whether or not the South can really declare itself in play with more than one or two states at a time that seem to really be at least interested in signaling some level of investment in Democrats in 2024.
Maya King is a reporter with the New York Times, and she has been generous with her time this morning on limited sleep. Maya, thank you, and I hope to talk to you again in this election season.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
This is Due South on WUNC. We're going to turn our attention now to the surprise of the night from my perspective. Colin and Chris, I want you to push back if you think there was a bigger surprise, but the brief context here is Republican Catherine Truitt, incumbent superintendent of public instruction, went down last night in the GOP primary to Michelle Morrow. Morrow did this on a shoestring budget, a relatively small social media following, and it didn't appear to matter too much. How did she do this, if you even have a sense of that yet, Colin Campbell?
You know, I can't claim to have a huge sense. Part of the problem for, I think, for reporters covering Republican primaries like this is there are the things that we usually pay attention to: who's spending money on ads, who's fundraising, who's you know, getting out there on the campaign trail, who's got a big social media following. And there's a lot that happens sort of below the radar. There's, you know, Facebook groups of concerned moms. There's groups like Moms for Liberty that are active in a lot of these curriculum issues. That seems to be what's driving a backlash against Superintendent of Public Instruction Catherine Truitt, is that there's a perception that she's not doing enough about you know, LGBTQ content in schools, things like that. And you've got Morrow, who is a homeschooler, hasn't actually sent her kids to public school, probably plugged into a lot of homeschool related groups, has called, I think, public schools indoctrination centers. So some really strong rhetoric for her, and it seems to be getting out to Republican-based voters in some fashion that you and I perhaps don't see as much as we do other channels.
And just to underscore this, this is not a general election. Catherine Truitt is a Republican's Republican. I mean, she is conservative. She helped write the Parents' Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we say it in unison. This is not somebody who is kind of, you know, fluttered away from conservative causes. She is a conservative, and she went down last night. The issue of education is one that we're going to ask Ben Shockman about from WHQR here in a couple of moments. But first, I want to give just a little bit of time tomorrow. Did text her late last night and early this morning. Did not get a response from her. But we interviewed her earlier this year here on Due South. We did a show on a Council of State races. The Superintendent of Public Instruction is one of 10 Council of State posts. Toward the end of that interview, which aired in late January, I asked the candidate, Morrow, what she thought the primary result would be. And here's what she said.
Forecast for me. What is the tally on Wednesday, March 6th? What percentage of the vote does Michelle Morrow have? What percentage of the vote does Catherine Truitt have?
Michelle has 80 and Catherine has 20.
What do you really think?
I think it's going to be 80-20.
You think you're going to beat the incumbent superintendent by an 8-2 margin?
Yep. I'm hopeful. Listen, I come to that number only because as I have been praying about what we're doing, that's the number that came to me.
I thought that was just a fun clip, a lighter clip, a North Carolina clip of sorts. Chris Cooper, this one surprised me. Gauge for me how much it surprised you. And if you have a thought on how Morrow did this, please share it with us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the biggest surprise of the night. I was shocked. I kept thinking, okay, when we get more results in, this is going to shift a little. Boy, it's closer than I thought. And then it turns out, obviously, that she pulled it out in the end. So what was it? I mean, I think some of it was some individual factors of that race and how much education has become a more salient issue for some Republican voters, but also think it was a bad night to be an establishment Republican in the state of North Carolina. So you've got Truitt, obviously the incumbent losing there. You've got John Hardister losing for Labor. A lot of folks thought he might pull it out. Of course, former or current member of the General Assembly. Deanna Ballard, former member of the General Assembly, didn't make it for the lieutenant governor, even into the runoff. John Bradford lost to Harris, as you already talked about. Gray Mills lost to Pat Harrigan in NC-10. So if you were an establishment Republican with experience in government, it was a bad night to be running in the state of North Carolina. So to some degree, I think it was the tide. To some degree, it was the specifics of the race. I will say a lot of us, including myself, saw unaffiliated voters choosing the Republican primary in big numbers, right? About two-thirds of the early voting unaffiliated chose Republican. So a lot of people, including me, thought, well, maybe that'll moderate the field a little bit. Maybe those folks are going to come over and vote against a Mark Robinson or vote against you know, some of these more MAGA-associated candidates. Turns out that is not what happened at all. It was a good day to be a MAGA candidate. It was a bad day to be an experienced establishment candidate in North Carolina on the Republican side, and as maybe we'll talk about later, a little bit on the Democratic side, too.
The one kind of sort of counterweight to that is the establishment candidate of Timothy Moore. Tim Moore, longtime Speaker of the North Carolina House. He did get the Trump backing. He also won in a Republican primary in North Carolina's 14th congressional district. That is a heavily right-leaning district, and Speaker Moore finally has his way out of Jones Street and to the Capitol. Let's turn our attention now to New Hanover County and county seat Wilmington, one of the purplest areas in our state, something of a bellwether across the last several election cycles. And here to help us get caught up on what happened on Super Tuesday and gauge just how purple it was or wasn't is WHQR News Director Ben Shockman. Hello, Ben. How purple were we on Super Tuesday?
We were pretty purple. I have to say, we saw largely Republican primaries across southeastern North Carolina, and a lot of interesting ways that played out in our neighbors in Brunswick and Pender County. I'll real quick say that Brunswick County is fairly conservative, but in much more of an old school, institutional status quo kind of way. All of the incumbents that we were following, by and large, in Brunswick County held on to their seats. Pender County, a lot more of this insurgent populist conservatism. We saw at least three or four incumbents lose their primaries to upstart challengers, many of whom refused to even speak to the press. Here in New Hanover County, it's purple. And what's really interesting is that what seems to be driving the more aggressive factions of the Republican Party continues to be education issues.
Let's build on that, Ben, because, of course, the big surprise of the night that we've talked about here on Due South already today is it's not a certified result, but incumbent superintendent of public instruction, Catherine Truitt, who is very much conservative, helped to write the Parents' Bill of Rights, which was enacted earlier this year, was defeated by one of these grassroots candidates, Michelle Morrow. So let's hone in on the education. You mentioned, Ben, just a moment ago, that there were three or four incumbents down in southeast North Carolina who were defeated. Were these school board races? To go second level here for us, please.
Sure. So in Pender County, where we saw a number of GOP incumbents lose their seats, we did see a school board member flip. But yeah, this was the incumbent Phil Cordero lost to challenger Tommy Reeves. Reeves is a hardware store owner, no apparent political experience before that. Again, declined to speak to the press that he'd rather spend his time at the polls. But we have heard that he, you know, runs in this circle of, you know, Moms for Liberty and other people who are very concerned with parental rights and, you know, what's being made available at school libraries and all of those issues. And in Pender County, Truitt lost even more than she lost the state. She got about 42% in unofficial votes. Michelle Morrow, really strong in Pender County.
I'm just doing quick math off the top of my head, but if Catherine Truitt received about 42% of the vote in Pender County, Catherine Truitt, Michelle Morrow received upwards of 57%, maybe closer to 58% in the county. This was just a two-person race. Michelle Morrow outperformed the incumbent Catherine Truitt by 15 or 16 points down in Pender County in the southeast portion of the state. That is a sizable margin, greater, as you point out, than the differential between them across the state. Education, it is certainly an issue that the right has been focused on and honed in on. Based on the results, just a knee-jerk reaction here, do you expect that this is going to become an even more prominent issue over the next 8 months?
Absolutely. And just looking at preliminary voting results, let me tell you why I think that, is that Trump came in at around 69% of the vote. And that's about, 10, 11 points below the state average. Mark Robinson for governor in the primary came in about 9, 10 points, rather, below the state average. But Michelle Morrow came in above the state average, 5 points above state average in New Hanover County, which is very purple. So conservative populist candidates resonating less in New Hanover County than on average around the state, except when it comes to these educational issues. And then that is really bringing out people to the polls.
You said it very well and concisely. I'm just going to mirror it back to you, Ben. Michelle Morrow appears to have outperformed Donald Trump and Mark Robinson in New Hanover County, and education would clearly be one attributable, if not the attributable factor here. 30 seconds left or so. Any other just knee-jerk rapid reactions that you want to share with us?
No, that was my big takeaway. I mean, based on state average, Michelle Morrow definitely outperforming Robinson and Trump lets me know that that is going to be the defining issue, or at least one of the top defining issues here in very purple southeastern North Carolina.
Ben Shockman, News Director, WHQR, thank you for the time.
Happy to do it.
All righty. Chris Cooper, let me turn to you after hearing from Ben Shockman. We've talked about this issue of education. It feels like, maybe I'm being a little reductive here, we've got education as the big issue on the right. We've got abortion as the big issue or one of the big issues on the left. Push back on that and or add to the poo-poo platter of issues that you think will be most important across the next 8 months here.
I love the poo-poo platter drop, by the way. But look, no, I'm not going to push back on that at all. I think in terms of statewide offices, education is clearly going to be a key issue. I think with federal offices, the border, I mean, you know, is clearly going to be the issue that the Republicans are leaning into. We're seeing that in the mailers we are getting. We're seeing that in the ads, right? I think when Addison McDowell announced that he was running for Congress, for example, we saw him connect the border to his brother's death from fentanyl. So that's, I think, right, a lot of things be connected to the border. But in terms of these statewide offices, in terms of local offices, yeah, we're going to see a lot about education. And I think, at least coming from the Republican Party, it's going to be leaning pretty heavily into or really against issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion.
All right, final few minutes of Due South here on this morning after Super Tuesday. Chris Cooper on the line, Colin Campbell here in studio. You can hear the speed of my voice. I'm going to go a little bit faster as I try to tick through some things that I have not yet gotten to tick through. Colin, give me a finger if you want to jump in here, just a little wave. And Chris, feel free to give me one of those throat-clearing things. Let's turn our attention to congressional races. We had five effectively open races. Let's begin in the sixth. This is where Kathy Manning, the Democrat, was gerrymandered out. It is headed to a runoff, a second primary. Addison McDowell, who received the Trump endorsement, and Mark Walker, the former three-term congressman who previously served parts of this district. Real quick, guys, advantage in the runoff, any sense of it?
I mean, I think the Trump endorsement's probably going to play big in the runoff. McDowell has been running on that since day one. He was able to secure that right out of the gate, I think, because he's hunting buddies with Donald Trump Jr. Former President Trump alluded to that. So I think that's probably going to give him a leg up going into this runoff.
Here's an inside tip that you can only get on Due South late in the game. Donald Trump Jr. has hunted for bear in eastern North Carolina before. I have that on good accord. Let's go to the 13th Congressional District. This is the severely gerrymandered district that looks like a reverse C, kind of, I don't know, hugging the triangle. Here, Kelly Daughtry, she finished first with 27% of the vote, and in second was Brad Knott with almost 19% of the vote. As a reminder, if you don't reach 30%, there can be a runoff, but the second place finisher has to ask for a runoff. And this 13th congressional was in a wildly crowded field of 14 candidates. Not a runoff in the 8th, as we discussed earlier with Steve Harrison. Mark Harris, advances. One other notable, I think, runoff to weigh in on here, guys. GOP lieutenant governor race. It's Hal Weatherman and Jim O'Neill finishing 1-2. This another muddled primary. Weatherman is the former chief of staff to Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest. O'Neill is the district attorney of Forsyth County. That's where Winston-Salem is. And he has run several times for statewide office. Give me a quick thought, if you would please, Chris Cooper, on the Hal Weatherman versus Jim O'Neill likely runoff in the GOP lieutenant governor's race.
I think it's going to be a MAGA off. I think we're going to see, obviously, pretty low turnout in general. But with that said, we haven't seen this many prominent offices up for runoff in North Carolina since we changed the rule to 30%. So we're in a little bit of uncharted waters. I'm not really sure who has the I don't know who's the favorite here. And let's add, too, we also have the auditor race on the Republican side, which I believe is also going to go up for runoff or for second primary, as we call it in the state of North Carolina.
Yes, in that North Carolina auditor's race on the Republican side, Jack Clark and Dave Boliak finished 1-2, neither breaking 24% of the vote. Boliak will need to ask for a runoff there, which I would think is likely. Well, we've made it through almost just about the entire hour, and I have not even mentioned that attorney general's race. It is Dan Bishop on the Republican side, waiting for now Jeff Jackson, who defeated Satana DeBerry, the Durham County District Attorney. Lots more to get to, and we have 8 months to do it. Big thanks to our panelists, Colin Campbell and Chris Cooper. Guys, appreciate all the knowledge this morning.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for the conversation.
Many other thank yous. Of course, Maya King from the New York Times joined us earlier in the hour. So did Steve Harrison of WFAE and Ben Shockman of WHQR. This episode of Due South was produced by Cole Del Charco. Our executive producer is Aaron Kiever, and our technical director is Denarius Thomas. This has been the latest installment of our Purple Ballot series. My name is Jeff DeBerry. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10:00.